From Capital Analytics, I'm Abby Maloney, and this is Invest Insights. Each week, we bring you perspectives, business advice, and more from the leading executives, entrepreneurs, and investors who are building, diversifying, and leading the way in the country's fastest-growing metro areas. Real leaders, real insights, right now. Welcome to Invest Insights. In today's episode, I speak with Dr. Stephen Klasko, the president and CEO of Thomas Jefferson University and Jefferson Health, and Dr. Jonathan Gleason, the chief quality officer for Jefferson Health, on how one of the largest hospital systems in Philadelphia has experienced great overall success in dealing with the direct and indirect coronavirus-related challenges. This episode was recorded on August 26, 2020.
Stephen, since the last time we've spoken, which has been a number of months now, we sit in August of 2020, Jefferson Health has cared for more COVID-19 patients than any other system in the Philadelphia region. And only about 1% of the staff at Jefferson Health have tested positive, even during the peak months of the COVID-19 crisis. To what do you credit the continued overall success of the organization's response to the pandemic and other related challenges?
First of all, Abby, it's great to be back on Invest Insights. It's a must hear, and congratulations on season one. So I'll give you sort of the framework, and Jonathan can talk to you about why we think we've been, and it's hard to say successful in a pandemic, but as you said, we've had almost twice as many COVID patients as anyone else. Honestly, and this sounds a little corny, but we really stuck to our values of put people first, do the right thing, and be bold and think different. And every one of those we did in our daily calls. So putting people first means that we didn't compromise even a little bit when it came to PPE from the very, very, very beginning. You know, no KN95s, no different gown policy, even when gowns went up from 20 cents a gown to $10 a gown, nurses and frontline people worked together. So that was to put people first and do the right thing, and that resulted in that low effectivity. To be bold and think different, we were the very early investors in telehealth. Actually, interestingly, two of our very early partners were Teladoc and Livongo, and they just merged this last week. But so we did 100,000 telehealth visits between 2015 and 2020, and then 100,000 in 3 months in 2020. Jonathan, you might want to talk a little about what we did specifically as it related to COVID that we feel was sort of a no-limits approach.
Sure. A couple of things that I'll point out, Abby. Number one is we were very early in going to an all-mask environment. And one of the reasons why we did that before the CDC recommended it and other hospitals were doing it was because of our global footprint. So, you know, we have a medical school campus in Italy, and we were in contact with them very early on in the crisis. And so we made that move very, very early on, and that allowed us to really protect our staff in a major way. The second thing that I'll point out is that we really were, we have tremendous expertise within our organization. Our chief of infectious disease, Dr. John Zerlo, trained under Dr. Fauci, and we gave him a lot of authority in developing our approach to the treatment of the COVID patient. And as a result, our inpatient mortality has gone down by over 60% over just a couple of months. That's a tremendous amount of improvement in clinical quality outcomes. And so, you know, we're really proud of that. And our approach was really to find the right expertise and to give them what they need in order to do their job. That's one of the principles of high reliability, is deference to expertise. And I think we did that well throughout the crisis.
Thinking of expertise, something exciting is that back in May of 2020, Thomas Jefferson University announced a partnership with the Bharat Biotech to develop a new vaccine as a new vaccine candidate for COVID-19. And I recently read that this is expected to reach clinical trials by December of this year. Can you speak to how this partnership came about? What is the process? What are you expecting?
I'm very proud of that because, Abby, we exist on a four-pillar model, academic and clinical, which is sort of the traditional math, and innovation and strategic partnerships. This brought in all four pillars. It started with a great inventor, Dr. Matthias Schnell. He's our director of the Jefferson Vaccine Center. He's also literally the chair of the NIH, National Institutes of Health, Vaccines Against Microbial Diseases Study Section. Had an incredible track record. He's already designed vaccines for SARS and MERS. So he came to us and went to the innovation pillar and the strategic partnership pillar. It's led by someone named Dr. Rose Ritz. They immediately filed a patent application, began brainstorming a strategy to find a partner. And what was really cool about what they did under the Be Bold and Think Different, they really said, look, CorVax uses a delivery vector. What makes it different, it uses a rabies vaccine delivery vector. So the great thing about that is there's already hundreds of millions of those vaccines made. This is just added to that. And then we said, what would be a good place to go and test it and a place that's used rabies vaccine? And that's India. So we partnered with Bharat. Bharat now is now in their hands. They're our commercial partner. They believe we will do human testing very shortly. And they believe we'll have a commercial product early next year. And remember, Abby, there's going to be a lot of products. So you might hear, Johnson & Johnson has this or Merck has this. It's a big world. Especially for some of the countries with large populations that are going to need something that can hit the ground running, like a rabies vaccine. That's been delivered already to 4 billion people. The early animal studies, Abby, are incredibly encouraging. That by two doses, you had exactly the same antibody protection you had as if you got a full COVID-19. So we're excited. Bharat's excited. But it made me happy because it really brought the innovation pillar and the academic pillar together.
We touched upon it a little bit prior. Telehealth and telemedicine is on everyone's mind. And you started some really interesting partnerships. Tell us where you see how it has developed telemedicine and telehealth in your experience. And where, as we sit now in August of 2020, where do you see it developing?
So Jonathan might want to talk about some of our successes, but I think I've tried to get away from the term telemedicine, Abby, because I don't think you get up in the morning and say, I think I'm going to telebank this morning. It's just that 90% of banking went from the bank to the home. 30 years ago, I mean, I was actually practicing. You were probably in preschool. But 30 years ago, during COVID pandemic, we would have been talking about people lining up on Friday to deposit their checks. So moving healthcare out to home, we call healthcare with no address. So it was incredibly successful at Jefferson. As I said, we did about 100,000 telehealth visits. It replaced a lot of our inpatient visits. It saved lives. We were able to get out to areas that might not have been able to get access. But here's what I worry about. Healthcare is incredibly fragmented in the United States. And part of the reason telehealth didn't take hold before is a typical insurer might only pay $49 for a telehealth visit and $250 for an in-person visit. And during the pandemic, everybody got together and said, hey, we'll pay you, just take care of the patient. Now it's already going back to that. Imagine back to banking. If every time you deposited a $1,000 check, the bank said, if you do it mobily, I'm going to keep $200 of it. You'd probably be going to the bank a lot. So I think, part of what I talk a lot about is we have to figure out a way that healthcare begin with the consumer. We just wrote a book with Hemant Taneja, the initial investor of Livongo, called Unhealthcare, a Manifesto for Health Assurance. Came out last week. How does healthcare start with people? How does healthcare not be figuring out what the insurer will pay or it's better for the hospital to have it done at the hospital? Jonathan, you might want to talk a little bit about how successful we were with telehealth.
Sure. So again, I go back to our international footprint here, and we in early February, we trained more than 1,000 physicians to transfer their inpatient visits to virtual visits. So meaning keep your schedule for Monday, but your schedule is now virtual and you're having the exact same schedule with the flip of a switch. You can do that from your living room. And we did that before it was really apparent that we were going to have a significant issue here in the U.S. And so when the crisis really came to our front door, we were ready and we were able to keep those scheduled appointments and just flip them into virtual visits. And so I think one of the significant changes that's occurred is that telehealth is now a tactical operating arm of our organization. And I can give you a great example of that. As COVID numbers were starting to decline, we had significant issues related to the social injustice that occurred in our country, and our community was out in the streets, and it made it not possible for some of our clinics to be open. And rather than closing those clinics, we just flipped those visits right into virtual. Those patients received care. And so, there's a sense in which we're never closed anymore. We're always open. And it really is the realization of healthcare with no address for us. I mean, that is the reality of our operating system at this point. We are always open. We're always available. We're always there for you wherever there happens to be.
And Abby, one of the things I just want to sort of accentuate is, you know, people felt that we were pretty quick on the draw as it related to COVID. And I think there were two really important things with that. One, Jonathan sort of intimated before. We had had a sort of pandemic preparation committee that went on well after Ebola. Not that we knew that this would happen, but we probably had more PPE on hand to start than most any place in the country, almost 60 days. But the second thing is we have a medical school campus in Italy. In fact, we're the only medical school in the world where you can graduate and practice in either the European Union or the United States. As you know, Italy got slammed, literally was one of the first European countries to be slammed. And we were having weekly calls with them before it was even an issue in this country, actually when the president was still saying it's not going to come to this country. And we were saying, well, if it does, what did you learn? What did you do right? What did you do wrong? And I have to thank our friends at Cattolica University and Gemelli Hospital because they were willing to be very honest with us about things like the importance of masking and the importance of the right PPE. So that helped us be prepared based on what had happened in Italy.
Stephen, you have written a lot about how hospitals can learn from the hospitality industry. And recently, you and Jonathan co-wrote an article for the World Economic Forum. Can you tell us a little bit more about that article?
Yeah, so that's how John and my relationship works. You know, I help him write an article and have everybody say, great job, Steve. And then Jonathan does all the work to create a company in 8 weeks with a Fortune 100 company. So I'm the spokesmodel for Eversafe. So I will hand it over to the person that co-invented it.
During the crisis, there were so many issues that we were dealing with that were not necessarily medical issues, that were environmental issues related to heating and air management, as well as foggers and just all these complex issues. And we were working with Aramark, which is a global company. They have 15,000 clients in 22 countries around the world. And they have really incredible expertise in that area of safety. They were dealing with questions around medical issues with COVID, and they were reaching out to us with their questions. And we recognized that together we had really a significant capacity for informing businesses on how they can operate in this world. And so we came to an agreement. We built what's called Eversafe, and it's an operating system and is now the standard operating platform for all of Aramark for safety. And we did that in just a couple of weeks. There was such a tremendous response to that from the business community that we've now made it available to other businesses. And so we're working with great clients, businesses around the country, and expanding even beyond our country to create, you know, really the material that people need in the operating system to be able to function within this environment.
You know, Stephen, the last time we spoke about the importance of the region's response, the Philadelphia metro area's response. And I wanted to ask your opinion, how has the region fared? In addition, I also wanted to, that the last time we spoke, we talked about the federal government and how it really needed to ensure that this experience from this pandemic would prevent something in the future. What have you seen from the Philadelphia region, and how is your take on the federal government's response for the future?
Well, that doesn't give me any chance to get in trouble, does it? Jonathan and I haven't really talked about this. I think Philadelphia has actually done, as has Pennsylvania, a pretty good job. They've conferred with folks like Jonathan and his colleagues. I think generally the health systems have gotten together in a way that they hadn't gotten together before. Look, I think that the federal piece gets down to this. There's really two things, and I'm on a radio show every week, and I say two things. Don't be a knucklehead. So, you know, in this country, we can't keep people from, you know, doing stupid stuff. And, you know, at the point that we knew that masks mattered, at least when you're in closed spaces. So I think that you know, it's a shame that people didn't come together like they did after 9/11. That's not either the federal government or the city's fault. I think what's really been disturbing, frankly, is, and this might get me in trouble, but is that lack of consistency. You know, the federal government saying one thing, states saying one thing, depending on whether Democrat or Republican. It really disgusts me, frankly, at this point, having any governor or anybody in the federal government high-fiving themselves, because we just haven't done a great job across the country. So you have, you know,
some of the Democratic governors just saying, look how great we were. And they probably really haven't looked in the mirror. We have some of the folks that let people out early and had the economy go, now we're getting it later, high-fiving themselves. So I think the fact is, what I hope would happen next time is that there'd be a lot more consistency. By the way, you see that in what's happening with sports. Again, I think it's asinine that the NCAA hasn't come with a policy. We have 16 NCAA teams. Division II, to their credit, which is what we're in, really came up with a Division II-wide policy. You have, three conferences saying we're playing, two conferences saying it's too dangerous. You have moms now getting involved. So what I hope would start to happen is that we would earlier on get a greater level of cooperation. Same thing with schools, by the way. At Jefferson, we've gotten together with seven. I run the university. We have seven provosts that have gotten together. Those seven provosts are doing a hybrid model. The provosts that didn't want to get together are doing all sorts of different things. So I'd say Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, by not being in the headlines every day, by definition, you've done a good job.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this was an unprecedented crisis. Not everything's going to go well in an unprecedented crisis like this. I think some of the things that we've learned are around supply chain within healthcare. I think a lot of deep thinking is going to go on around, what do we need to do to mitigate the risk of having an international supply chain, particularly around critical safety issues with pandemics. I think that's one thing that we've learned. And then some of the lack of coordination really is a function of, how we have separated powers between the state and the federal government. So there really isn't a great venue for them to be sharing information. A distribution of power, allows there to be some sensitivity to what's going on locally, but it certainly makes it difficult to coordinate and to have a cohesive response. And I don't think you can look at what's occurred here in our country and say we've had a cohesive response.
And I think the one absolute from a federal point of view that we'll be looked back on, just like we look back on 9/11 and say we weren't ready for domestic terrorism, will be the lack of a federal supply chain. I mean, the fact that we, had whatever the percentage is, 80, 90% of PPE come from one country because it was less expensive. The fact that we didn't have vast supplies. I mean, this is a war on this virus. And when you think about the nuclear stockpiles and other stockpiles we have in case somebody invades us, we knew that this was a possible invasion. And I think hopefully we won't get caught flat-footed again.
Yeah, as long as Dr. Klasko and I are working, we're always going to have, I don't know, what are we going to shoot for days on hand with PPE from now on, Dr. Klasko?
How about 365?
365 days, right.
We can always sell them.
Exactly. So, I think one of the things that we're talking about and thinking about and talking to government officials about is, in 5 years when people have forgotten a little bit about this, are we still going to, we need to right now be thinking about and learning from this and building a better system to protect the supply chain moving forward, because it'll be very easy to forget.
You have been listening to Invest Insights. Be sure to follow, rate, and review this podcast to hear more. I'm Abby Malone. Thank you for tuning in.